This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the NCAA ends their boycott of North Carolina over HB2, but they do so reluctantly and with strings attached. Charlotte's homicide rate continues its rise. There have been 27 murders, putting us on track to surpass last year's record. What CMPD has to say about this trend? One Charlotte mayoral candidate seems to be outstripping the other two in fundraising, and that candidate is not the incumbent. And Kennedy Meeks from Huntersville finds his mug on the cover of Sports Illustrated as the Tar Heels win the national basketball championship. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and many more, and they are as follows. Please make a note. Tom Bullock from WFAE News.
Am I like the A bubble on the form?
You are, and you're on people's right.
Hold your applause.
Glenn Perkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. He's straight ahead of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Os Helms to my left, education reporter from the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg sitting to the left of Glenn Perkins,
someone
staff writer at the
and to the right of someone else.
That's right, to Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for being here. You can reach us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, hashtag WFAE Roundup, search for WFAE on Facebook, or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. So the day after the repeal of HB2 last week, the NCAA's Board of Governors voted to reluctantly consider bringing some of their playoff games back to North Carolina, and they will keep the games scheduled to be played here in 2017 and 18. This doesn't sound like a guarantee, though, is it?
Well, you're not going to be guaranteed in any way because you're bidding against other cities and states. But you're right that this is probably the most tepid endorsement that could be possible from a group that is considering your area for its events. So I think that North Carolina is going to get something. April 18th, I think, is the date that the events will be awarded for the next 4 years. What I wonder is, based on that statement, whether it will be less than what would have normally transpired over four years.
And I'm willing to bet that's probably true, because what everybody's talking about here is the basketball, the March Madness for both men's and women's. I'm willing to bet that some of the other smaller profile championships have already been sorted out, because if you think about it, they've got a long laundry list of sports, you know, ranging from, you know, field hockey all the way up to basketball and football that need to be sorted out. It's not a guarantee, to go back to your question, Mike, that's for sure, but it does end the boycott. It's a guarantee that you will be considered again. But yeah, this was an incredibly tepid statement, and it clearly doesn't, you know, one of the things that's most interesting is the NCAA said, if we don't see guarantees that all fans and players are treated the way we want them to play, then we will take appropriate action.
And so that raises the interesting question. They're saying they want documentation from the sites that there will not be any discrimination. And the question becomes, what would that documentation be?
What does that mean exactly?
Right, because the HB 142 says that these cities cannot pass any kind of LGBT protection. So the ACLU is now filing public records requests with a number of cities and a number of universities saying, I think, essentially, what kind of documentation do you have that you don't discriminate?
Well,
they're seeking additional documentation demonstrating how student athletes and fans will be protected. And evidently, they are going to go to those institutions and sites, not just like if they play a game here at the arena, Spectrum Arena, they will go to the arena and say, what are your policies? And if they're not up to our snuff, you're not going to get the game.
Which, you know, let's just take Charlotte as an example. I don't think Charlotte's going to have any trouble in that regard, because start with the Spectrum Center. They already have a policy of you go to the bathroom you want to go to. They've said that numerous times. And I think most of the hotels obviously involved in what's the campaign, Welcome One, Welcome All, or whatever it is. So I think that they'll be able to show that pretty easily. I think that it really goes back to what Tom's saying about, you know, the ratio of how many events come versus what would have happened.
Glenn.
But even if we're talking about public facilities, I think what we have to keep in mind, for better or worse, is that the current law takes us back to where we were before the Charlotte Ordinance, when the NCAA did bring tournaments here. So we're
all
really,
the time.
All the time. I think they were really in a bad situation, because once you get both parties to agree to this compromise, it's really hard for them to say, we're going to continue the boycott. At that point, what they would have been saying is, we know better than all of your elected officials, and we should be the governing body.
In their statement, the NCAA says, this new law restores the state to the legal landscape that existed prior to HB 2, which you just said, which is similar to other jurisdictions presently hosting NCAA championships. But they also say that this new law has minimally achieved a situation where we believed NCAA championships may be conducted in a non-discriminatory environment. What I inferred from that statement is that other states in which they have games also have only minimal levels of protections, and yet there has been no reluctance on the part of the NCAA to put those games there. Why are they reluctant to bring them back here?
It's a great question, and I think it actually, if I can just slightly morph what Glenn said, it doesn't just take us back to pre-Charlotte Ordinance. It kind of has this offshoot because we are frozen. You know, pre-Charlotte Ordinance, cities and towns, municipalities could pass their own non-discrimination ordinances. They could also do things like regulate public accommodation spaces with ordinances and rules. Both of those things are now barred by House Bill 142. And that's – I still stand by that. I think that the line about
– For 3 years.
Well, yes. I'm sorry. Until 2020, okay. December of 2020. But I do think that that may actually complicate things in terms of the documentation that the NCAA is seeking. Because if municipalities are not allowed to regulate public accommodations, which they are not under the law of the state now, then how do they morph public spaces? Private businesses were always able to do what they wanted to do. But these public spaces, I'm curious to see what documentation they show up.
So nobody was really pleased by the repeal of HB 2 on either side. It was kind of a bitter compromise. And evidently the NCAA isn't all that pleased, and Governor Cooper acknowledged that.
Clearly they wanted a clean repeal of House Bill 2, as did I. But it is important that they recognized progress in this legislation.
So what message should that send to lawmakers, if any?
Well, I don't think that – let me back up. I think that the lawmakers got what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Right. they get the boycott removed. They get the basketball back at a time when North Carolina is rolling into the national championship. And their hope not publicly stated, but their hope is that this will sort of shuffle off to the side and they can – move on to other issues, taxes and regulatory reform and the other things that this General Assembly is much more interested in doing.
I think if we pull up to the really high view, what was the message out of all this? One of them is that being LGBT friendly is good for business. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case within our lifetime. So I think that's something that's in the atmosphere.
And we
now
talked about this when they pulled the games, when all these leagues, the NBA, the ACC, the NCAA, pulled these games. It seemed like it didn't seem like part of their culture, this protection of LGBT people. Will this cause the NCAA and other organizations now to push for more?
Well, they're going now. They've staked out a position. It's going to be hard to go backwards, I think. The second element, though, is, for example, a week ago, former Governor McCrory was giving a radio interview, and he said that
he does that still.
He does that still, I guess. And he said he made a comment that by passing HB 142. The state had gone back to a time when things were just fine. And I think that is the kind of statement that's probably going to keep this issue alive in terms of you still have no protection for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender.
And you're barred from giving them.
So I don't know that this puts it to rest.
Glenn. You ask what message this sends. I think one of the messages that it sends, and I agree with what Ann said, but I also think it sends the message that the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. In the letter you read, the NCAA pointed out that North Carolina is now squarely where some other states are in terms of LGBT protections and restroom accessibility. But North Carolina made the mistake of sticking up as being that nail that stuck up.
Well, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals this week out in – where are they?
Chicago.
Chicago. Said that the Civil Rights Act, which talks about sex, or whatever the act is that talks about protections for no discrimination based on sex,
Title
covers
nine?
LGBT.
Title
no.
Title 7.
Oh, Title
it
7,
covers
okay.
LGBT. So but does that settle this argument
no,
once and for
because
all?
This is about – the case was about workplace. Workplace discrimination based on sexual – and it was sexual orientation. It's a very kind of specific ruling. Now, that opens the door for more conversations. It potentially can be seen and will be used in legal briefs as a form of precedent. But it is not the kind of groundbreaking case for two reasons. Number one, again, it's about employment discrimination based on sexual orientation that may or may not, depending on interpretation, include transgender individuals. But number two, it's not our circuit court. So this applies, you know, around the Seventh Circuit, but we're under the Fourth. So, you know, what this could do, though, is it could speed up the process to get these conversations happening at the Supreme Court.
Because
level.
We've had the Virginia case, which is in our circuit, the Fourth. So, and I think that is probably the hope of a lot of people on both sides, that this winds up going to the Supreme Court. And, of course, we have interesting news about the Supreme Court that I'm sure Tom Ashbrook will
later. Well, yes, because they're voting today on the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to be the next Supreme Court justice. The NCAA statement brought up something that we really didn't talk about last week in the immediate aftermath of the repeal of HB 2. They point out that the new law allows, and this is a quote, cities' existing non-discrimination ordinances, including LGBTQ protections, to remain in place. The problem with that is that during a previous attempt to get a repeal of HB 2 agreement passed, Charlotte repealed its ordinance. And I asked Bob Morgan when he was on this program if we should ask for a mulligan, and he asked me to... Surely he plays golf. He said, what are you talking about? A do-over. Should we get a do-over? Do other municipalities have these ordinances on the books?
It's a really interesting legal question, but I'm not sure they can. They may still be on the books, but HB 2 rendered them null and void. I don't know with the removal of HB 2 if they're suddenly back again. There were a couple of municipalities that had protections for veteran status, and they were rendered moot by HB 2.
So were the people in Charlotte who were against repealing the ordinance right?
I'm not going to say one way on that, because here's the thing. What seemed to be about to take place in December was a repeal, and a repeal that frankly would have probably—
A clean repeal.
Yeah, that would have been more palatable.
No strings attached.
Yeah.
It would just go away. And Tom, I'm sure everybody at this table has noticed that part of the big pushback from Equality NC and Human Rights Campaign and other groups is, hey, wait a minute. Charlotte repealed this ordinance and the state did not in turn get a full repeal. So they are very bitter about that. They've called Governor Cooper a sellout. So there's plenty of tension and blame to go around on that score.
Yeah, the LGBT community has said we will continue our work to fight for statewide anti-discrimination protections for LGBT North Carolinians. But how, when you have a legislature that is intransigent on this point?
I think you're starting to look now after new election cycles, and they—
But given the way our districts are drawn, et cetera, is that just a pipe dream?
I think that their best hope, I talked to some political scientists this week, and they all seem to agree that the best hope is that this winds up in the Supreme Court, and you have a federal decision that does to this what happened with same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. That's probably the best case scenario for these groups that are fighting for LGBT rights.
I think the challenge, as you correctly pointed out, is the General Assembly in North Carolina. If you look at the landscape nationally, what's happening is that cities are leading some of the more progressive fights, whether it's climate control, climate change, LGBT rights. A lot of the progressive changes have been coming out of city governments. North Carolina's General Assembly has shown no appetite for letting its cities decide for themselves.
Our homicide rate is up. We'll be talking about that in a moment. We come back on the local news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms from The Observer, Eric Spanberg from The Business Journal. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Aldersgate, undergoing a transformative expansion of its 231-acre campus that will include 62 new apartments and villas. Details at aldersgateccrc.com. And Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, new location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. Debate over abortion is expected to intensify in the current political climate, and that debate has already started to play out in Charlotte at a local women's reproductive health clinic, frequently the site of protests. Those demonstrations have recently become larger and more hostile, and another fight about the nature of the protests has also begun. So we're going to focus on both protests and how they intersect with free speech on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Trump and the World, our nuclear Senate, Bannon bumped a gas attack in Syria. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point, coming up at 10 following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Before we move away from this NCAA thing coming back, the next shoe to drop, or I'm not sure that's the right term because that's usually a negative thing.
The next ball to drop.
It would be the NBA and their decision. Will they come back? Will they bring back the NBA All-Star Game in some future year to Charlotte as the result of this repeal? Who would like to answer that?
I don't want to use the phrase slam dunk decision because that's so hard. Horribly cliche, but
cut down the net.
Yes, they'll cut down the net. So it could come as soon as this afternoon. The NBA Board of Governors is meeting this week, and the commissioner typically speaks with the media at the conclusion. That should be this afternoon. So if they brought that issue up, which everybody thinks they did, then we could know as soon as this afternoon.
So when might the first game be? Because it was supposed to be this year.
Yeah, it would be 2019. What they had told the Hornets was, we're taking 2017, you get 2019 if there are significant changes to HB2.
Tom. And that's the one thing I want to point out here. I think the NBA will probably follow the ACC and the NCAA. I'm not going to say the slam dunk, though, and not just because it is horribly cliche.
Oh, no, no. I was making a joke.
Yeah.
I don't think the NBA is the most progressive sports league by far.
Yeah.
So it's not a given that they're coming back.
This is a quote that Adam Silver told reporters last year, which is about House Bill 2. The bathroom issue has become a little bit of a distraction. From the very beginning, that was not the core issue that the NBA had with the law. So I'm very curious to see what they do.
Yeah.
And basketball, not business, evidently, seemed to be the prime motivating factor for the legislature to repeal HB2. Charlotte and North Carolina did suffer from a loss of business relocation. We suffered due to lost revenue as well. And on Monday, I asked Charlotte Chamber CEO Bob Morgan about the impact of this then and now.
We've had four companies, including one as recently as last week. They are coming to Charlotte. They are actually expanding in Charlotte, several hundred jobs. They're not going to announce it. They don't want to tell anybody because the political groups on both sides of the spectrum want to engage. They want to put pressure on companies. They want to put pressure on the NCAA. That part of the battle is probably going to be with us for a while.
So will we ever know the full impact of this? Because what he's saying essentially is we don't know what we don't know, what we lost because we don't. Now we don't know what we might get because they're not talking about it.
There's an additional side to this.
Donald Rumsfeld's head is spinning. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. I spoke with him as well, and one of the things that he confirmed was something that a lot of people have speculated about, which is that companies just flat out took North Carolina off the list, period. Not under consideration because of House Bill 2. So, you know, you have the AP coming out and saying that, you know, over 12 years, it was, what, $3.9 billion of lost economic activity here. That may or may not be accurate. Hmm. Now, the question, though, is we may not ever know the final cost, but it has enough been done to repair that image that you can start seeing things come back. It took years, if not decades, for South Carolina to do it, even while the Confederate flag still flew on the Capitol.
Well, and remember a couple of things. There's still cities and states who have maintained their travel ban over the policy in North Carolina. Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, has said several times over the past year that he has been told face-to-face by executives that they simply are not going to consider North Carolina because of what's going on. So that's sort of thing one. Thing two is, remember on the other side, what you hear supporters of HB2 saying is, hey, look, $500 million $1,000, which is sort of the going rate of what was lost, that's 0.1% of the state GDP or state economy. So why you know, get so wound up about that? Now, I think that argument begins to fall apart.
Well, you know,
we don't know what we don't know, but also because nobody is supporting loss of jobs, no matter how small it may or may not be.
I've never bought that argument. It is factually correct, but conceptually, in context, it's silly because honestly, what diehard, you know, lawmaker from either party would not be jumping up and down to say, I've got a jobs plan that will bring half of a percentage point to
PayPal.
State's overall economy.
You might even have a governor who would stand next to an executive from PayPal and say 400 jobs are coming and this is a great thing.
And at the same time, Bob Morgan has pointed out that we actually brought in more jobs in 2016 than in 2015. So, you know, there are lots of ways to parse the numbers. I think possibly because HB2 was always in flux. You know, constantly it was in the news, but that maybe it was going to go away. Maybe we didn't get into that trough that you get into. If this
but I think what it has to boil down to is nobody is for fewer jobs.
Yes.
Right.
And when politicians are saying we need to bring this sports team or that sports team or we need to build this arena or that stadium because look at the exposure that we'll get and the image it will recreate in the national zeitgeist because of the television exposure, what has this done on the other side of that equation?
Well, I mean, absolutely. You don't have the events. Let's just take a simple example from last month.
I'm just talking about events. I'm talking about the image.
Yeah, we
of
got
North
a lot
Carolina.
Of television exposure.
Oh,
we were the punchline on late night TV for a solid year.
People know in California, they know what HB2 means.
Right.
That's all
absolutely.
Have to say.
Yeah, we're
absolutely.
The bathroom bill state.
Maybe I can bring a little bit of a personal anecdote here. I grew up out west. And I remember when Colorado used to be known as the state of hate because of something called Amendment 1 that ended up being a Supreme Court case that actually is going to come into play one way or another with the lawsuits that the ACLU and others have filed here about North Carolina's first HB2 and now HB 142. And, you know, for a long time – and what that did, Amendment 1, in case people don't know, is it barred municipalities from passing non-discrimination protections.
Sounds familiar.
So it took a very long time, I mean years and years and years, before that moniker disappeared from being associated with Colorado. Now, Colorado is, you know, it is a really fascinating state. It's split between Democrats and Republicans, urban and rural. It's got a lot of the same dynamics that we have here. But if that's a lesson that can be learned, it will be a while before.
Absolutely.
Don't you think it would have helped if they took the thing off the billboards as you come into this welcome to the hate state? It would have helped. End it sooner, don't you think? It's a joke. Never
the
mind.
Other thing we should, the other thing we should note is that while HB2 is what's in the headlines now, North Carolina's notoriety began before HB2. It started with some of the voter changes.
Yes.
So North Carolina's negative reputation, if you will, extends way beyond HB2, and I think that's something that we have to recognize.
Okay, moving on here. Charlotte's homicide rate continues to rise. When I wrote the promo for this show, which is the little announcements that we run about what's coming up, when I wrote them on Wednesday, the murder rate was 25. When we recorded them yesterday, it was 27. The Observer reported this morning that at this time last year, the murder rate was 16, I believe, so we're one above double. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney says his department is doing what it can to combat the problem. Do we understand its underpinnings? Do we understand why the murder rate is rising, Glenn?
I've not heard anyone give a really credible explanation for why the murder rate is up so much. There's been speculation that it might just be a statistical blip. The last time we saw a murder rate this high, there was a clear explanation. We were in the middle of a crack crisis. There was a crack epidemic, and gangs were fighting for turf, not just here, but in cities all over the country. Even during the Great Recession, when the economy was bad, we didn't see a rise in the murder rate.
In fact, the numbers went down.
Yes, in fact, the numbers did go down. So we really don't know what's happening. What we do know is that a lot of these involve young people who are using guns to settle disputes away from police. People are saying we need to get more officers on the street. In fact, one of our mayoral candidates came out with a plan yesterday to advocate that. But there is no real indication that that would solve this problem. People don't commit murder in front of police officers. They commit murder in their own homes or their friends' homes or at a party or whatever. And as Chief Putney has said a number of times, those are the really hard ones to prevent. If you put police officers on the street, you can prevent muggings. Mm-hmm. You can prevent some types of crime. Robberies in a different murders in a different category.
And that's what they're doing? CFPD putting more police officers in
those neighborhoods? You've got Kerr Putney saying we've got officers in all the hot spots. We're out there. And, you know, by all accounts, they are. But Glenn is exactly right. Murder, a lot of these murders, it seems, are, I mean, they're clearly not going to be done underneath a street lamp.
And depending on how those police are perceived in the streets, it can either be a plus or a minus, whether people trust them and may go to them if they see a problem brewing. Although, again, there's only so much you can do, even if you know there's a
potential violence. And the proliferation of guns, the access to guns.
But if they are viewed as the occupying force, then you may see even more, let's settle this outside of legal channels.
At one point, and I think this was Kerr Putney's predecessor who did this, I'm not sure, but at one point he got people out of cruisers and on the streets walking. Sidewalk walking, because police cruisers are not friendly. There's no interaction. Whereas if you're in the neighborhood walking and you're talking to people as they pass you by, is that still going on?
I don't know if that's still going on. I think something that might actually be more effective is something else I think his predecessor did, and that is target certain individuals. If you go to the sheriff's website and look at who's being charged with these murders, mm-hmm. they are not first-time offenders. These are people with very, very long records. Some of them have been arrested 7 times, 8 times, 9 times, 11 times. One of the things that Chief Monroe did was he put a lot of pressure on some of those repeat offenders. And you know, would that work? Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't.
But that's actually a program that's been used in other cities, and it's had kind of overall positive results. It's basically this idea of identify who this person is with, you know, friends, groups, gangs, if that was the situation, and call them in and say, look, if something happens to Mr. and Mrs. X, just know we're going to come to you and we're going to be asking you questions because we know that you guys are in rival groups or we know that you guys have had a dispute. But there's another thing here that I think is troubling. And for anybody who is interested in a really fascinating read, I would say go to – I can't remember. I believe it's the January edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association of this year. And there's a Yale study that does something that's really phenomenal and rather frightening, which is it shows how gun violence – can be a social contagion, a lot like a virus. And it is spread through social media, and it starts to wind down this perception that murder is a bad thing, and it starts normalizing it. And that's something that I think is really disturbing, and I'm not sure how anybody.
I noticed that in one of our many articles about homicides this week, when I went to the jump page, there was an article right above it that was about a domestic situation, and the man had been arrested for making some harassing calls to this woman's workplace, and it went on to say that she had left an abusive situation, and he had been stalking her, and he'd had, you know, arrests for all sorts of violent crimes, and there were 2 restraining orders on him. And you read that and you think, boy, if you ever wanted to see somebody that might be the problem, that's it. But what do you do? You can't go in and throw somebody in jail forever because he's likely going to do something bad.
Well, here's what CMPD Major Cam Selvey said about the department's efforts to fight this epidemic of murders.
It's our belief that by targeting individuals who we see over and over again, felons who we get information that they have weapons, I think we can prevent a lot of violent crime and hopefully prevent some homicides.
And, Tom, we have started tracking murders in Charlotte on our website at WFAE.org. What do we hope that listeners and visitors to the website will take away from that?
I think Sarah D'Elia, who's the lead reporter on this and has done really great work along with Jennifer Lang, our web designer, it's simple. It's to humanize this. It's really easy in these conversations to think about numbers and not the fact that these are people. And yes, some of them are troubled, and some of them, you know, could have done lots of bad things, but others are just innocent bystanders. And all of them have a story, and all of them are people. And it's a way to also kind of track it in terms of, you know, where they're happening, who were they, mm-hmm. what was the status of it. I really encourage people to go to the website and see what we've got there.
I think we had the case this week that just, you know, really rattled everyone of the couple in their 60s who had lost one son to murder had taken in his 11-year-old daughter, by all accounts doing a great job of raising her. Their other son, who had a troubled life, is now charged with killing both of them and kidnapping the 11-year-old. And there was this car crash in Washington, D.C., where the man who was charged and the woman he was in a relationship and the 11-year-old girl were all in the car fleeing the police, you know, and you just think.
And she called 911, didn't she? Somebody in the car called 911.
I think the last I read was that they thought it was his partner as opposed to the girl. But, yeah, somebody female called 911. And the girl apparently got out of the car crying, "Help me." So, you know, that's the kind of thing everybody can relate to that. But, you know, what do you do about
it? Fortunately, and she was, 11 years old, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Fortunately, she was not a murder victim. But the part of this murder epidemic in Charlotte is now involving children. It's involving teenagers. Mount Holly police are looking for a second Charlotte teenager who may have played a role in the murder of a 14-year-old girl on Monday in Mount Holly. The second suspect is also a teen. What do we know about this? Anything?
Again, the homicide detectives are saying we can't tease this out. This isn't something like a gang conflict in schools where it's really obvious that Group A is targeting Group B. It appears to be. They're saying in most of these cases, these were people who knew each other. I mean, this goes back to the first one of the year was that horrible case, the 14-year-old who was the son of a police officer and did not appear to be engaged in any kind of risky lifestyles and was shot in front of a relative's house. So, yeah, not only are we talking about teens who are victims, but teens who are accused.
CMPD also revealed, I think this week, a proposed plan to keep people safe on greenways and on the light rail. And what leapt off the page to me about that is I didn't know that people were unsafe in those locations. They are?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say unsafe is a strong word. I think we need to qualify it. This comes after one woman, I believe.
Well, they said keep people safe, so that's why I said unsafe.
And a specific force made it. I was a little surprised by that, too. I didn't perceive that as our biggest crime issue. But if you're regularly on one, you may.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it's a surprise with something like a greenway that there is potential for crime there if you're away from stuff. And to be clear, what the police would do is create a new division that would be, the transportation division. So they'd focus on things like the greenway and the light rail. But I don't want to make it sound like there's a huge crime spree happening on the greenway.
And I think we have to be honest as well and acknowledge that in any city, law enforcement and city leaders are going to want to protect their marquee assets.
Right.
And our greenways, our burgeoning light rail system.
And particularly with the light rail about to expand.
Exactly.
Well, to do this would require an additional 125 new officers over a two-year period. It follows an increase of 63 officers last year. The chief has asked for 62 more officers next year. They currently have about 2,000. Chief Putney has said on this program that Charlotte, for the size of the population, is under-policed. When he asked for a bunch of officers last year, there were so many of them that he couldn't have possibly trained them in the time allotted. And now Joel Ford, who's running for mayor, wants to do something similar to what Kerr Putney asked for before.
Actually, he wants to add 100 more to what Kerr Putney
asked for. The city says we're already kind of working on this. So is there any indication that they'll find the money for this?
It's not just the money. It's training.
It's the ability. There's a limited number of officers that you can bring in per year.
Everybody knows the police academy. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just like a trade school or a college. There are a certain number of slots that can be used to train a certain number of graduates in a given year. And right now, it's not like you can just automatically deputize a bunch of people and turn them into trained police officers. There's
but
training.
Can you hire from like smaller surrounding police forces and bring them in or no?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to.
I think what this indicates as much as anything is how much this is going to be a part of this upcoming mayoral race.
Yes, mm-hmm. That is the key point.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that when we come back a little bit. We'll talk about CMS. There was a school board meeting last night at Myers Park High School, downtown. We'll get to that as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Core 365, directly serving Charlotte organizations since 2008 and offering comprehensive information solutions, including document scanning and shredding. Detailed information at cor365.com. And Bojangles, featuring 5 combo meals all day, every day. Bojangles, chicken and biscuits, serving the Carolinas since 1977. U.S. missiles hit Syria in response to this week's chemical attack on civilians. The Senate goes nuclear over the Neil Gorsuch Supreme Court nomination. And President Trump and China's leader open a summit at Mar-a-Lago. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about in the national and international portion of this news roundup, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock with Tom Ashbrook on Point. You can join the conversation here, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get us through Twitter at Charlotte Talked and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. We're coming right back.
Whether the day's news unfolds in your hometown or somewhere across the globe.
We know that the bombing occurred mid-afternoon in downtown St. Petersburg.
President Park Geun-hye is expelled.
Mubarak left the Cairo hospital early this morning. A free man.
NPR is there. We check the facts. We track down the details. We bring you voices from people at the center of the story. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
Stay in touch on air at 90.7 WFAE and online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News, and Ann Dotz Helms, reporter with who specializes in education and has for years at the Charlotte Observer. So let's talk about the schools, because last night there was a school board meeting. And yesterday, when I was thinking about what I was going to ask you about this meeting, I know that one of the things that they were going to bring up was going to be the budget. And you said prior to that presentation that you suspected that Ann Clark, the superintendent of schools, might be asking County Commission for more money than the commissioners say they're willing to spend. That's always the case, it seems to me. What did she ask for last night?
Well, and to set the stage for anybody who's not familiar with this, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools is our largest local government entity by far, but it doesn't have taxing authority. So when Ann Clark presents a budget, it's a large portion of it is saying, here's what we think we're going to get from the state. That's all up in the air now, so giant question mark.
Yeah, the whole thing is backwards. The process is backwards. They come up with what they need, and then they have to go and they have to anticipate funds
right.
from the state, which may or may not come through.
So things like
and then
what
they have
the
to go
raises
ask the county.
Will be, what
yeah.
you know, whether this K-3 mandate will require them to hire or shift teachers. You know, still up in the air. But what this really is about is, here's the request we're going to make for the county commissioners. Excuse me. And the total amount is $440.5 million, which, of course, sounds like a large amount. It's an increase of about $27 million, although CMS would point out that if enrollment trends go as we think they do and a whole lot of the enrollment growth goes to charter schools, we'll only get to keep about $20 million of that and pass $7 million of it on to the charter schools where Mecklenburg students go.
Yeah.
And they're saying most of the rest of this is keeping up with raises, with benefits, with rising costs, with growing enrollment. So the only really big new thing they're saying is a request for additional counselors, social workers, and psychologists.
Which are needed because of this rash of murders. Is that why?
Not exclusively that, but boy, you could not illustrate it better. I mean, Ann was saying that, Ann Clark said that on that Thursday morning, she got a call that the latest teen homicide victim was a student at Garinger High School. So the first thing she did was get on the phone to line up a social worker who would work with the boy's family, a young man's family, and additional counselors to come in and work with students and faculty. Because, you know, people can say schools should only be focused on teaching academics. But if you have just had someone die and or somebody just from your school be charged with a violent crime, that's disruptive, as is poverty. You know, if you're losing your home, if your family is in turmoil, and this doesn't just happen in poverty.
You can't learn when you're in crisis.
Right, and mental health issues, and CMS has given a lot of credit to the county commissioners. This is not actually part of the school's budget, but the county is paying to have mental health professionals in more than 100 schools who can have on-site mental health counseling for students and their families. So this is part of a long-standing recognition that kids are not little robots who come in and take tests, that they come in with their lives and part of that violence we're seeing.
Glenn.
There was a community meeting earlier this week in, I guess, West Charlotte at New Zion Baptist Church, where they met to talk about the disparities in discipline that's meted out in CMS. But it really became a conversation about some of the things that Ann's talking about, some of the problems that are in CMS schools that lead to these suspensions. You know, this is a huge problem. For whatever reason, we have far too many children coming from low-income families, from families that don't stress education, And if we're ever going to fix that problem, fix the suspension problem, fix the problems in general, we're going to have some type of comprehensive approach that's going to involve these counselors, these very people that they're now requesting.
Well, I think, and that when you look at Project Lift, that's an attempt to try and figure out a model of how to deal with this, because essentially what we've gotten to is that we need a social services component as part of education, because no teacher could ever solve all of these problems.
Right, and that's, I think, why people would say these support services are not just giving something to families or to communities or even to children. This is helping teachers teach effectively.
Absolutely, yeah.
Also, we've been waiting for CMS to release their school assignment plan, and yesterday you, Ann, raised the question about whether they may have done it already. You reported that diversity moved down and schools close to home moved up on the revised boundary policy added to Thursday's school board agenda. That meeting was last night. What did it turn out to be?
Well, this was just a first reading on a policy that they've been discussing forever, and they were quite emphatic about saying this is not a change. These are the same four criteria that they've had that we talked about, I think, last week, things like diversity, how close to home your school is, whether the feeder patterns stay together, and I'm forgetting what the fourth one is. But what they did was alphabetize them and take off numbers instead. You know, it had number one, socioeconomic diversity, number two, whatever. And people read things into that. There were people who were concerned that diversity was going to drive everything else. So they alphabetized it, and you might be wondering how neighborhood schools or proximity would be at the top of the list, but it was because it is average distance from home. So now people who are wanting to see a higher emphasis on diversity are saying, that's kind of questionable. Why would you change it if it doesn't make a difference? But they're going to hold a public hearing on this on the 25th on these criteria at the same time that Ann Clark is going to present her list of specific changes. So it's kind of a weird, you know, you can weigh in on the criteria that we are using to make these decisions that we are now presenting to you as made. Hmm. So this is going to be a really interesting.
It comes across as a fait accompli.
It kind of does, yeah. And you can also say that the board has agreed to these principles, although when they started talking about how you take all these four things and how you prioritize them, they sort of defaulted to they all have equal weight, but not because everybody agreed that was going to yield a brilliant plan, but because, you know, some people wanted this one. So there's still a lot of tension out there.
And the school board voted last night 6-3 to add new schools for West Charlotte High and Bruns Academy to the $795 million bond request, which would raise the need for about $126 million more.
That would seem to point to a search for votes, would it not?
It would exactly point to that.
Yes.
And, you know, we talked about, and I didn't answer you well about whether the operating budget request is going to be a big deal. I think it's not, and that number is not insurmountable. The $27 million is a big chunk, but they say they have $35 million anticipated worth of additional revenue coming in. So that one may not hit, but boy, when they come forward and say, here's our bond request, we have two schools that we are now jumping over a lot of other projects. And Bill Malik, County Commissioner for District 2, which is the West Southwest area, has been adamant about you will not get the West Side votes for the bond unless we get these two schools. And everybody agrees these two schools, it would be a good thing to tear them down and build new buildings, that these are dilapidated old buildings, that these neighborhoods deserve new schools. But mm-hmm. when you have a countywide list and you say, we have methodically itemized them and here's the order now, and I'm just picking this number out, but say it's number 90 jumps past, you know, the next 40, that's probably too dramatic. But there are a lot of people that are going to look and say, wait, I was one school away from being in this request. I'm going to have to wait years mm-hmm. for either the new school that will relieve crowding or the renovations that my school also needs. And meanwhile, politicking got
when
these
you,
two
but when you
up.
Neglect a side of town for
yes.
years, and we have neglected the west side for years, every once in a while you have to throw them a bone.
And that was the argument
yeah.
for this.
And I think that's an excellent point, Mike. I think it is looking for votes, but I think more than that, it might just be the right thing to do. That part of town has been neglected, and there is anger in the African-American community right now about the school system and what's happening and what's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more than just vote shopping. I think a lot of factors play into it. I think But as much as anything, I think it's a recognition that we've got to do something in these very low-performing schools, at these very low-performing schools.
Meanwhile, the new superintendent who takes the job, starts the job on July 1st when Ann Clark retires, Clayton Wilcox, is assembling his cabinet. What does
he
that mean?
He is starting to, and it's been an interesting dynamic. Like with the budget, they apparently have worked together, which is good. You would hate to think that, you know, they would go through all this and get a budget, and he would walk in and go, eh, what's this? So he's always sitting in the audience these last several meetings. And they introduced four members of his cabinet. They're making the appointments effective July 1st. So two big things to me. One is he is bringing in a chief of staff from his school district in Washington County, Maryland. And this is a big deal because some school board members said in hindsight, after things went sour with Heath Morrison, the fact that he didn't bring anyone with him maybe was a sign that he was not as good a manager as they thought he was, that maybe nobody wanted to come. So he's bringing in a chief of staff from his current district, which is going to pose the question of who becomes the point person that actually knows CMS.
Right.
The other thing is they announced a new opportunity for Avery Mitchell, who is the head of human resources. That says that they are going to bring in a new head of human resources. And that, when you're talking about a workforce of 18,000, that is always, and that has been a perennial concern that HR is not done as well as it should be. And they've tried corporate people and they've tried educators, which Avery is primarily an educator. We're going to see now what Clayton Wilcox can do with that.
Over the course of history on this program, in the 56 or 7 editions that we have done, we have talked a lot about House bills. Let us talk about a Senate bill, Tom.
Oh, wow.
Senate Bill 325, which has been referred to as the billion-dollar middle-class
I'm going to stop you right there.
Cut.
It's not referred to.
Yeah.
That's
it's called
its technical name.
Oh, sorry. I was
yes,
giving you a
PT bar anybody,
there. I was going to ask what's the actual title of the bill. That's the actual
title. The billion-dollar middle-class tax
subtle,
cut.
Very
yes,
subtle.
But, of course, you know, it's one of the
– I, Mr. Chairman, I. Go ahead.
It's one of these things that I think is fascinating. When you watch bills, whether it's state level or up in Washington, the names of bills has really become the cornerstone of the legislation. One of my favorite ones just came out this year is the Hearing Protection Act. And guess what that's about?
Hearing protection.
It's about
loudness.
It's about making it easier to buy silencers for handguns.
Oh.
What?
No joke.
Well, see, Tom, you've been laughing about the Observer's headlines, trying to pull in readers. You know, it's all part of that trend. You got
to
set the tone. You got to pull people.
So,
in.
What does this bill do? It's a billion-dollar middle-class tax cut. Enough said.
Yeah. Thank you. See you next week.
Yeah, Tommy Tucker, who you know from Union County, he stressed that name again and again. And in my story, I couldn't help but start quoting a little Juliet because what's in the name? He wanted to make sure you knew what was there. But the question is, I mean, really, there are two key points here. The first is 99% of North Carolinian taxpayers look to get some form of a potential cut here. But you also see major increases in things like the amount of mortgage interest you can deduct.
Yeah.
You see major – in fact, it's unlimited – it would be unlimited charitable contribution deductions, unlimited medical cost deductions, and a significant cut in the corporate income tax rate, which –
three to 2.5%
by 2019. So
the personal income tax rate would be the lowest in the Southeast. Is that right?
Well, I always
– more than South Carolina, really?
It technically would be, but it's just like teacher pay. When you hear lines like that by legislators, it assumes that the other states leave theirs where it is because this gets phased in over a couple of years. But yeah, if South Carolina didn't do anything, then yes.
So with all these tax cuts that are proposed in this billion-dollar middle-class tax cut, must come cuts in services. What are they cutting?
Well, they say that they don't need to.
What?
That's what they say. And that part of this is, you know, the state is, and this is a fact, is having a budget surplus of about $500 million. They are projecting that is – I mean, this is a philosophical argument, a philosophical belief between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans in the state legislature truly believe that the economy is booming because of tax cuts. And they're projecting out that the economy, the surplus, will continue to grow. But the key thing here, and this is what was fascinating about this debate, is, again, mortgage interests, unlimited charitable deductions, and corporate tax rates, those have very little impact on the middle class. So there was one Democratic senator, Senator Clark, who came out and said, all right, I like this idea. I like the amounts. Let's go ahead, though, and cap it so any family that makes over $200,000 a year, which is not middle class,
right.
they remain revenue neutral and you shift their tax cuts to the lower income brackets. He also included a provision which would leave the corporate tax rate where it is. Amendment fails. And then you have Floyd McKissick, who is just like, you know, comes out again and says, why are we not investing?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what you've heard certainly from Governor Cooper, and you hear it from groups like the Budget and Tax Center. They've said for, I guess, the last 5-6 years, their, I guess, counter to the Republican philosophy of building the economy is that these state services are not – they're suffering. There needs to be more spent on education, social services, healthcare.
Well, yeah, we have no money to build roads. We have to have Centra come in to build a toll road. Right. We have no money for education. We have no money for this, no money for that. So why
– So this is a furthering of that argument. Tom's exactly right. It is an economic philosophy that is being fought out along political lines. And right now, the General Assembly is controlled by Republicans. This is their philosophy.
Okay. Very quickly, Jennifer Roberts is the incumbent, but she's not. She's being outraised by Joel Ford, the state senator, who's challenging her in the primary. He's raised $200,000 so far. I think she's raised, $68,000 by the end.
Her numbers were only through the end of the year, so it's a little
correct.
Bit skewed.
We don't know what she's raised, although her spokesperson says that they've raised about the same amount.
Okay. Moving on.
Comes in. Blocked by Meeks. Barry up ahead to Jackson, and he dunks it down for the 5-point lead. Matthews off the mark, and this year the confetti is going to fall for North Carolina. They're not going to be denied this time.
CBS TV's Jim Nance describing the final moments of the NCAA championships on Monday night. I kept watching for a while, but no confetti fell, which was very disappointing. Very disappointing.
It was metaphorical confetti.
That's right. Here's Roy Williams, the coach of the team.
They wanted redemption, but I put in the locker room up on the board. One of the things we had to be tonight was tough enough, and I think this group was tough enough tonight.
And meanwhile, West Charlotte
sports
graduate
quotes.
Kennedy yes, right. West Charlotte graduate Kennedy Meeks is on the cover of Sports Illustrated. What's next? Box of Wheaties? Seriously.
Well, probably the NBA would be my guess, right?
maybe one more year.
Congratulations to them, and congratulations to the women of South Carolina, who took the NCAA basketball title without moving the entire program to Connecticut.
Coached by former Charlotte Sting player Dawn Staley.
Gamecocks.
All righty, go Gamecocks. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Ann Doss-Helm, Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, QCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock from W.